Canon USA Incorporated. Mr. Thorpe was a Sony broadcast was with Sony Broadcast Company from 1983 to 2003, and prior to that, he worked for RCA's broadcast division from 1966 to 1982, where he developed a range of color television cameras and telecine products. Before that, and from 1961 to 1966, he worked in the designs department of the BBC in London, England, where he participated in the development of a range of color television studio products. Mr. Thorpe is an IEEE graduate in 1961 of the College of Technology in Dublin, Ireland, and received his Chartered Engineer and MIEE distinction in 1961 from the Institute of Electrical Engineers in London. So my pleasure to welcome back Larry Thorpe.
If you followed all that, you can see why they call me a senior fellow. This topic, I have to learn how to do this. It's when you release the button, I fire it over here. There we go. First of all, I think it's important to understand what's been going on worldwide in the last decade and more on the future of digital program origination. There's been the, if I call it the television-centric, which actually started as digital cinema with the ITU, but then when Hollywood stepped in and said, no, we'll do digital cinema, then the ITU branched off to look at UHD in both its embodiments of the 4K and the 8K, while Hollywood continued, drew up a spec, handed it over to the SMPTE, and the SMPTE have now a whole raft of specs related to digital imaging at 2K, 4K, 8K. The 8K up here, is still going on. The ITU put out the initial draft, and the small tweaks being made to it, but 4K and 8K are specified there. So there are a blueprint for quite a distant future going on there. Now, just to backtrack a little bit on where some of this digital stuff came, the high-definition camcorders that were born in the 90s, Hollywood started to get interested and said, if you could make a 24-frame version of that, we might use that for some movie-making. And that's when, based on the back of 2/3-inch high-definition camcorders, the famous 24P agenda was launched. But then things became really interesting in the mid-90s, in the 2000s, I should say, when DALSA turned up at an NAB with a large format single sensor camera prototype that sort of astonished everybody. It was a very large physical camera, but it had image quality that was very, very interesting, especially to the movie people. And after that, it was like one after the other. Every NAB, it seemed somebody would show up with a large format single sensor camera. And that list, as you'll see in a few moments, has just continued to grow. And then in 2008, the company which I'm now a part of popped up with a thing called the 5D Mark II, which absolutely had no aspirations whatsoever into the television or movie-making world. It was designed at the specific request of Reuters and AP, who wanted a DSLR to do their digital publishing, still imaging, but asked if we could add video so that they could do web, all from the same camera. So this was born with some modest specifications. But the thing that sort of reverberated around the production community was that very large sensor, the full frame 35 millimeter image sensor. And that just got attention like you could not believe. We had no idea the phenomenon that this would become. Now, it hasn't gone and shot full-length television dramas and full-length movies, but it has been used today in literally hundreds of movies, and pretty well all the major television dramas that you see today has a 5D or its successor as a B or a C camera doing niche special shots. I mean, for $3,000, you're getting this incredible picture quality. that very shallow depth of field that these folks love, and they can tie that camera onto motorcycles, drones, all sorts of things, and not worry too much if it gets damaged. On a recent movie that was shot, both our high-end, top-of-the-end camera and some of these, I think eight were destroyed in a movie that involved an awful lot of speed racing cars. But anyway, that started us on a little odyssey. First of all, the reason for its success I list here, and this was things that just grabbed the attention of people. When this first came out, I took it out to Panavision to be benchmarked, to have them independently look at the HD. They spent 3 days testing it, shook their heads and says, "You're dead, this will never fly." But then they gave it to a DP who shot some images one afternoon, and we looked at those images in the theater and it was, oh, cancel the test charts. The pictures are pretty darn good. And that's the point. That's why it was successful. The subjective images, the aliasing, all the nasties of it that I list here were pretty forgiven, because for the price, they were getting something that they couldn't quite get from any other digital camera at the time in terms of the size of the sensor. But anyway, it was based on the success of that that we began to be serious about maybe the time has come for Canon to get into the digital cinematography business, primarily based on the fact that a lot of our technologies had come of age. Image sensors developed by Canon, lenses developed by Canon, processors developed by Canon. So we had all the ingredients in-house. It was just a business decision to go for the high end, and we took that definitive step in November 2011 to develop serious video cameras for television and movie making. Now, just look at what's happened since 2008. There's some names up there you may or may not recognize, but it just doesn't stop. At last NAB, you'd be dizzy going around looking at all the folks making large format cameras. And the astonishing thing is the spread in the spectrum of prices and performance. I mean, Blackmagic, $2,500, a 4K camcorder, and pretty interesting. Not quite the same as a Sony F65, but the point is something for everybody. And of course, that's the business model. And with motion picture film, which I never thought I would see collapse, it's just collapsing rather rapidly. And you're seeing more and more major movies now being shot digitally. And with the cameras, there has grown a huge global industry of folks who, now that videotape is gone, and memory is the name of the game, recorders. And again, the number of these are just proliferating, and the spectrum of products each of them are making is spreading. So both the shooting and the capture are advancing very, very rapidly. So at this moment in time, the large format cameras have found their niche in certainly in movie making, and I'm sure you've seen some of the major movies that have been made. And they're not all at 4K. There's a lot of these cameras are at 2K or HD. Skyfall shot in HD. Some of the major TV dramas, Downton Abbey, all of that shot HD, but large format, single sensor. So what are the implications for television production? Well, I list, it's my list, I'm sure each of us would put a different list up, but I said, well, these may be the principal genres of television origination. And how many of these could use a large format rather than, say, a 2/3 inch or some of the smaller format 3-chip cameras? And it really comes to looking at your production budget, the type of production, and then looking at what's available out there in terms of small format and large format cameras. And I, based on my experience, would summarize choosing a camera based on four things, each one of which can get quite involved, but I break it down to these four here. And we'll examine some of the large format offerings against these down the way a little bit. But first, if we look at, I wish I could see this better. Let me see if I can move that over there. There we go. The primary determinants of image quality, I would be starting with the lens. Now, sometimes in the television world, the lens is sort of secondary. It's the camera gets all the attention when you're making a major decision on a studio. And some will say, well, the lens is an accessory. But when you talk to the film folks, it's quite the reverse. The first thing they think about is the lens. They do get it that it is the lens that has to intercept the wavefronts coming from the three-dimensional scenes out there and do a transformation to a tiny little two-dimensional image that's projected onto an image sensor. And then the camera's role, basically, is transformation. It's to turn optics into electrons and then do some digital processing. A panel I was on recently, a cinematographer said the lens is the brush that brushes the picture onto the canvas of the image sensor. I thought that was an apt description. Now, if we look at the many dimensions of what it takes to make a good quality image, I would list them as here. Obviously, some of them very centered about the image format size and the lens, but others, as you will see in a moment, the lens and the camera stamp a footprint on each. And then when it comes to motion imaging, today we have so many frame rate standards around the world. 24 is now firmly established in the television world and movie world, 30p, and then the international. But slow motion is something we're hearing about, seeing about more and more, certainly in sports, and definitely in drama and movies. So today you'll hear a lot, you'll see a lot in all of these cameras with tremendous capabilities that you would not have seen a decade ago in motion capture. Now, the point I would like to make is that when you're talking about image quality, and I list those key parameters, the key dimensions of what makes a terrific video image at the output of a camera, both the lens and the camera stamp each of those with a footprint. In the case of the lens, it's pretty indelible. And you can't do much better. The camera can't improve any of these. It can do alterations, and that's what things like post-production are all about, is pushing and shoving the video, but the initial quality is heavily stamped. So if you want the best imagery, you need the best lens and the best camera. But of course today, because of the spread in production budgets and the different program genres, you will see cheap lenses on expensive cameras, and you'll see cheap cameras hanging on to expensive lenses, and interesting debates about all the above. But this is pretty rock solid. If you want the best, you simply gotta pay attention to both. Now, and this is where the whole issue of large format, the importance of depth of field. Its size of the image format is the primary determinant of depth of field. It can then be further modified by the videographer or the cinematographer playing with light, lens aperture, shutters, and moving the object distance can play with depth of field. And even with a 2/3 inch small format, if you go wide open, you can get a relatively shallow depth of field, which is what made 24p work initially. So depth of field refers to the scene side. You have only one point that you can do your ultra sharp focus. The minute you move from that, let's say that's a person, fore or aft of that person, it begins to blur a little bit. And the depth of field they talk about, you can get into mathematics that talks about circles of confusion, but it's a degree of blurring, typically about a 50% reduction in MTF here and here, when you're imaging, would define the depth of field. On the image sensor, we talk about depth of focus. That, of course, does transform back here, and you have depth of focus. Now, the small image format size, which our whole world has been revolving for the last couple of decades, is small image format is deep depth of field, and consequently a deep depth of focus. And the creative values of a deep or long depth of field are that it can be used in certain program genres where you want to convey a lot of visual information about the environs. Examples, I'm just grabbing pictures here. In news, you want to be able to have a nice sharp focus on the speaker, but you also want to know what are they talking about, what's going on in the background. You want all of that in focus. And it goes on after that, all sorts of news situations. Now, it may not be news, it could be documentary, but sometimes, again, you're trying to convey something about an environment, only a deep depth of field will do that. Here again, it's desirable to capture the totality of an environment while having a sharp focus on the speaker. Sports, we generally like to see the environments, the stadiums, in some sort of focus on the wide-angle shots. And then, of course, wildlife, natural history. You do a lot of both, actually. You will do a lot of deep focus, but you also have a need for shallow focus. And again, it's environs and trying to capture. That's why your 2/3 inch has been famous for a pretty deep depth of field. Now, it brought its own problems into the studios, that having that deep depth of field with a 2/3 inch studio camera, you better take care of your backdrops and your sets, because they will be clearly seen in high definition television, and that's why such sets can cost a lot of money today. The film folk were very smart. They like to defocus the backgrounds a lot, and that can help expenses. The 1/3 inch format, which today is just proliferating all over, certainly in the news environment, gives you an even deeper depth of field. Now, the large depth of field, or the shallow, large image size, gives you the very shallow depth of field. And the creative value of that, well, you see it all the time in movies, you see it all the time in television dramas, and that is being able to draw your attention, the viewer, to some specific subject in a complex scene. I want to draw attention to the pair of glasses and not to the environs or the person, or vice versa. You see it all the time. And that's where the large format gives enormous control over that depth of field. I could have one moment showing the fingers here, and then just gently racking focus. I could focus on these fingers here, and you will see that done live often on concerts, etc. Here's a case where I want to draw absolute attention to the figure, the subject, and I defocus the foreground, I'll defocus the background. Now there's only one thing that you can really focus on. To bring, create mood and drama, I drew these yellow lines which are defining, this is your depth of field here, everything before and behind is defocused, and now you're more aware of the loneliness of this figure, which is the creative desire of that director and cinematographer. Racking of focus, when there's dialogue going on between two folks, this person is speaking in focus, out of focus. Suddenly, this person is going to reply, the focus, and you'll see that live on air, that rack focus, or live in the movie. Huge creative tool that is deeply, deeply imbued in the film world, the motion picture film world. Now, if we look at all that's available in current image format sizes, in the smaller formats, the red is the 2/3 inch, and then the green is the 1/2 inch, mostly supported by Sony alone today, and then the 1/3 inch supported by many, many manufacturers. I just draw your attention that while 2/3 inch itself is very small, the 1/3 is really, really small. And now there are the 1/4 inch and even 1/5 inch out there in some of the cameras that are available today. But that 1/3 inch is 3.5 times less area than a 2/3 inch. That has all sorts of implications on performance, optical performance, and image sensor performance. I don't have time to go into it today, but it is interesting that still today, the only internationally standard camera lens interface is the 2/3. The 1/3 is a de facto, where somebody came out with it and then the other manufacturers, some of them, copy it, basically. The famous PL mount that's used in the motion picture industry, developed by Arri, they have never licensed that, never put out the spec, and yet it was reverse engineered by all the film camera manufacturers of the world. It became a de facto standard. But this guy was thrashed out. It took 5 years to thrash out this standard back in the late 80s between all of the optical manufacturers and the camera manufacturers. So that's pretty interesting. I think it says 2/3 inch is still going to be pretty mainstream in studios. And of course, in studio, in sports, in other applications, non-broadcast Congress, mega churches, that two-third inch is probably still the most popular. And allied with the studio cameras and field cameras, there's just an enormous number of three-chip, two-third inch camcorders out there. And of course, in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been probably a more rapid evolution of the three-chip, one-third inch camcorders for news. And that is now being augmented by the single-chip, one-third inch to drive costs down and down. And this is interesting because obviously once you have a single-chip, one-third inch, you're doing a lot of the same processing that you do in the large single sensor formats, using bare patterns, etc., on that single sensor, and then decoding those with sophisticated algorithms to reconstruct the red, green, blue frames. And this is an arena which we play a lot, and we also play in the three one-third inch camcorders. Now, this new era of large format single sensor cameras, this is the full frame that you'll find in DSLRs. This was initially for still imaging, then elevated when Reuters asked for motion imaging, video. We created new sensors that could go at higher frame rates. But for our entry 2 years ago into digital video single sensor, we developed this sensor very specifically for motion imaging, all the way up to 120 frames a second. And it's based on the Super 35 millimeter, which is a format that is 120 plus years old. The original format developed by Edison and Eastman is the Super 35. So well established in the motion picture film world. There are other formats. If you want the Lawrence of Arabia, go to 65 millimeter. But this has done the bulk of the movies we have seen. And I've drawn to scale, by the way, the one-third inch, just to show you how much smaller it is in area than either of these. And these I've drawn, I've put in the dimensions. This is equivalent to that full-frame slide that we all used so affectionately years ago. And this is the Super 35. Now, large format sensors, even though today your industry is very, very based on two-third inch, half-inch, one-third inch, probably those three. Large format are not new to television because not terribly, terribly long ago, the center of the universe was 30 millimeter plumbicans. And then that was followed by the sort of upstart of the time. And I do remember the fierce debates among broadcasters. How could we ever put a two-third inch into a studio camera? It took some years to convince broadcasters to do that, but the pickup tubes got better and better. But the most important, of course, evolution was when we went to the solid-state sensor. And we jumped straight from the two-third inch pickup tube. The first CCDs put into television professional cameras was two-third inch, even though the size of the image sensor there is less than two-third. The diameter of this was two-third, and the image sensor size itself was 11 millimeters, and they kept that for that direct step into solid state. Today, of course, we have an era of smaller and smaller image sensor sizes. So if you look at the universe available to you today, this sort of summarizes it. You can buy professional cameras based on all of these solid-state images. And you've probably noticed that in the last 4 or 5 years, the CMOS is moving extremely rapidly, and now, no doubt, it's surpassing the CCD. It is the sensor of the future. A couple of reasons for that. It's lower power. It can go at much higher frame rates. And again, that interest in high frame rates is just growing. And I think we'll see. The CCD won't roll over and die. There are companies like Sony that are still doing sterling work in the arena of CCD, but they're also in CMOS, as are most other of the major manufacturers. But I do remind you, there's the 30 millimeter drawn to scale against the two-third inch. So we did have an era of some 20, 25 years where shallow depth of field in our television studios was the norm. And the 2/3 inch sort of changed that for us. Maybe for the good, but I would submit for some programs, maybe not for the good. But that is just a reminder. And of course, some of us affectionately remember the cameras that went with the 3rd. This was my last project at RCA, my good old TK-47. So now I've drawn the 2/3 inch, the 30 millimeter Plumbicon, and the Super 35, just to give you a perspective when drawn to scale. So this large format that we're talking about today is considerably beyond the 2/3 in terms of shallowness of the depth of field, but not that much more shallow than the 30 millimeter Plumbicon. Now, small format tri-sensor HD cameras, the famous 3-chip, is the beam splitter, 3 chips, and you directly read out full bandwidth, RGB, go into processing, and do whatever you have to do, go to 422 and your various codecs for recording, etc. The large format single sensor camera is much simpler, and it is absolutely based on the film camera that was its predecessor, not quite predecessor, but parallel. The flange to aperture depth in most of these digital large format cameras is the same. And that's because we wanted to be able to take the motion picture film, 35 millimeter lenses, that huge inventory around the world that hung on film cameras, and just transfer them over to the digital cameras, and they would perform with the same focusing capability. So that's, you can see how much simpler it is. Now that's where the simplicity stops, because now you have a single sensor. And remember, this large format single sensor, or could be a small format, 1/3 inch, is a monochrome sensor. We make it into a color sampling sensor by overlaying a color filter array according to, there are various patterns, but the most popular is the one shown here. It's a Bear pattern, developed in 1975 by Dr. Bear at Eastman Kodak. And it obviously clearly favored, in terms of spatial sampling, favored the green over the red and blue, because green is the biggest contributor to luma, and luma is what gives you your brightness and detail. So it was a pretty sensible choice at the time. But now, you typically, if you look at all of the cameras out there, the Sonys, the Aris, the Reds, etc., everybody reads out of that single sensor one readout. So you come out with one wire, and that wire is carrying the digital data in which is embedded the encoded red, green, and blue. And it's known affectionately today as a raw signal. You've probably heard that term a lot. And now the task, either in the camera or downstream in post, and both variants are there, you have to demosaic or debare that signal and reconstruct 3 parallel red, green, blue video components that then go in for traditional video processing, or perhaps somewhat untraditional if you're doing special movie type stuff. And that debare is an algorithm, because what you're going to try and do is take a rich green, which is still sparsely sampled in space, because all those reds and blues are pushing it out, and then the red and blues are very sparsely sampled, and it's arguable that in terms of spatial sampling, this is 420 sampling. And you have to now reconstruct full bandwidth, 1920 by 1080 red, green, blue, or if you're in a 4K camera, 4096 by 2160 red, green, blue. Now, obviously, you're at a disadvantage because you're missing an awful lot of information. So it's a reconstruction process that today is, there's just so much global horsepower behind debaring. It can be done in real time with unbelievable chips, or it can be done in software in non-real time, where you've got lots more processing to do a better and better algorithm. Just go on Google and look at the number of learned papers on demosaicing. But the name of the game is you will end up with red, green, blues with construction, reconstruction errors in them. Then it's a question of degree. How good did camera X do in its deburring algorithm? None of them are perfect, but one has to say they're all very good. I'm emphasizing this because I'll show you in a moment another way of skinning the cat, as we say. And here it is. How can a 4K image sensor make spectacular HD? Not 4K, but HD. And there I'm going to take you on our little odyssey of what we've done in the last 2 years, or do it rather rapidly. In November 2011, we introduced a high-definition camera, high-definition only, 4K image sensor. We followed that with the same image sensor, the same camera, but an appendage on that camera with a lot of processing in it. And now that 4K, same 4K as this, can produce 4K video from this camera, or 2K, or HD. You can switch between three modes. Then we made a DSLR with a full-frame image sensor that can record 4K on flashcards in that DSLR. And it can be switched to record HD, originate and record HD. And then we followed with the baby brother, the C100, which, like this fellow here, is exactly the same camera, 4K image sensor, 4K, 4K. This guy records MPEG-2 50 megabit. This guy records AVC HD 35 megabit max. So obviously, it's a cost hierarchy that we were structuring. We rolled all four of these cameras out last year throughout 2012. I'm going to spend a little time on this guy because it's very, very interesting. So that's just to summarize these three variants, 100, 300, 500, uses this same chip. And this guy, DSLR, uses the large chip. Now again, I'm reminding you that Bayer, I'm giving you a close-up, in its television 4K mode, it is twice HD across and twice HD, 1920 multiplied by 2, 1080 multiplied by 2. And we call this UHD, the CEA call it that. It's 4K, but television flavored, slaved to HD. We can switch the same chip, to be 4096 samples. And now you've got 4096 by 2160. That's the one specified by Hollywood, by the DCI. So cinematography 4K is 4096. Television UHD, and this is what's written in that ITU standard I spoke about, is this. Now, you see this close-up. There's 3840 by 2160. If I rip those, the color filter ray, just bust it apart, this is what it will look like. And you can see what I mean when I say sparsely sampled. There are gaps, and even here, there are gaps. Now, this guy happens to be 1920 by 1080. This guy happens to be 1920 by 1080 inside that 4K image sensor. This guy's a little odd because he's 1920 by 2160. But this is actually two separate greens, each of which is 1920 by 1080. Or you could switch it to be 2048 by 1920 by 1080 if you want the cinematography mode. Why is this important? It's terrifically important. Because unlike the traditional Bayer sensor, we do not read out one wire with the encoded signals. Buried inside the image sensor itself, we have a very sophisticated readout architecture where we reach in. With CMOS, you can reach into a pixel. You can't with CCD. We reach in. And we read out in parallel, in real time, those four components. In other words, we get in there and we decode that baby bear inside the chip and then feed out four data streams, each of which is 1920 by 1080. We then add these two greens to make a super green. What does that mean? Well, that takes a little explanation, and it's the secret sauce of this camera. I'm showing here, just by a deliberate miscoloration, the way the two greens at the photosite level in the color filter array are staggered. A single pixel on this guy, this 1920 by 1080, is this purple. And the active part of it is there, but that is the pixel. In this 1920 by 1080, this is the active photosite, that is the pixel. And there are 1920 by 1080 of those two reds and purple pixels. Now you will note that this pixel and this pixel are spatially offset, horizontally and vertically with respect to each other. When you add the two, the first order sideband, when you sample, you get sidebands. That's what creates aliasing. The sideband of this guy is reversed to this sideband. And when I add these two videos, that first order sideband cancels. Total elimination of the first order alias. This is huge. And it's true horizontally, and it's true vertically. You've still got a second order sideband. All cameras do. And the way the second order sideband is dealt with is that in the readout, this part here is the spatial sampling. In the readout, you've got a timing difference horizontally and vertically. You've got a one-line time difference vertically. Horizontally, it's very tiny in microseconds. And when you add two signals with timing difference, you create an FIR, a finite infinite array. I always get that one wrong. FIR filter, a cosine-shaped filter, which clobbers the second-order sideband. So by adding these two videos, we effectively reduce green aliasing to zero. That, in turn, allows us to open up the optical low-pass filter that's in front of the image sensor, raise the green resolution, and green being 70% for luma, we now give you a luma signal that's higher sharpness and less aliasing than any three-chip studio camera out there, HD. And this is HD we're talking about here. This is very, very important. And in fact, this camera will deliver 70% at 800 TV lines, HD. And your best 2/3-inch studio cameras today are typically around the 45 to 50. So this is using a 4K image sensor in a very novel way to create an extra performing HD. No aliasing, no debarring, no reconstruction errors, no aliasing, and no compression involved. So this baby makes pretty spectacular HD. Also, when you add the two greens, remember I called it super green, this is the image sensor, what's coming out of the image sensor, the noise floor and the full well of the image sensor. When you add the two, you double this, the 40 becomes 80. The noise adds, but it adds as the square root. So you get an effective boosting of your signal-to-noise ratio in green, which is an effective boost to the dynamic range. And in this camera, that is 12 and a half stops of dynamic range. So it's a very powerful methodology to mobilize the 4K image sensor with the parallel readout, the summation of the greens, and then what we do is we slot them in to the RGB alpha of the SMPTE, and we deliver on the camera output a 3G SDI that's carrying the RGB components, 444, RGB, 1920 by 1080 each at 12 bits. So I would submit this is one of the most high-performing HD cameras out there today. It's quite extraordinary. Now, it's also very interesting. This just shows you that a little bit about the processing, that we come out with for onboard recording, we go into a codec. We still record onboard at 50 megabits per second. That becomes your proxy for editing. But on the 3G SDI, we're giving you the 12-bit 444 at 60 frames a second, P. If you go to 422 10-bit, I'll give you 120 frames with this camera. And 422 12-bit is not too shabby. So it's quite a powerful camera. So in summary, it's no deep air, no compression, 444, super green, 12-bit, and we apply a Canon log curve, not a normal gamma, so we can capture all of that 12 and a half stops of dynamic range. Hugely important for television drama and for movie, perhaps not for many other television program genres. So again, another way of looking at it, this is common to all three cameras, the same image sensor with these characteristics, but the processing that I've just described is unique to the C500. Now, color reproduction. The three-chip camera, color reproduction has always been a very, very complex topic because you start out with a spectral characteristic of whatever light you use, and today there's a lot of choices in lighting. Tungsten, LED, the hot topic of the moment, HDMI and all the others, not HDMI, HMI. That has a spectral characteristic. The lens has a spectral characteristic. The IR filter has a spectral characteristic. The beam splitter has the three spectral characteristics. The image sensor has a spectral characteristic. And what goes, the footprint on the video going into the processing is the multiplication of that by that, by that, by that, by that. That's complex. And then you go into your red, green, blue processing for linear matricing, which is, if you will, the final tweak to try and meet color imagery specified by Rec. 709, or in the case of the movie world, the new DCI P3, a wider color gamut. So very sophisticated, and a lot of the high-end 2/3-inch cameras do a spectacular job on this. They've had many years to perfect it. It's a little more simple in the single sensor camera. You don't have that prism. Prisms have their own little complexities. Eliminating that is huge. But the color filter array, the magic in here is what's going to define your color gamut. And this is an area where we've spent a tremendous amount of our scientific work developing our own. So I'll end up with just saying, I've described how the 4K camera makes terrific HD. Let me now show you how that same camera, the same camera, can make terrific 4K. I won't call it as terrific as the HD, but anyway, again, just to remind you, there's two flavors of 4K, the television and the cinematography. There we go, try that. And what we do, we form what we call a bare RGB RAW, and that is our defining 4K output. Now remember the four components that we've ripped out. Each of them is a 2K. I'm showing it here now with the cinematography. Each of those components is a 2K. So we have four 2K components coming out in parallel. Between them, they carry 100% of that 4K information. This time, we do not add the red, the two greens. This time, we slot the four signals into the RGB alpha specified by that SMPTE 3G SDI. And that 3G SDI then outputs from the camera a serial signal which is carrying those four components, those four 2K components. And that is sent out of the camera as a file. We structure a file. This is 8196 by 1080, the multiplex of the four. And then there's a lot of management files, audio files, but these are sent out as clips into one of those recorders that I showed you earlier, a Kodak, an S2, an AGA, any of those recorders that work with our camera, most of them do now. And we call them RMF files, raw media files. So they're sent out, and if you're doing 4K, up to 24p, 25p, 30p, you only need one 3G SDI. If you go 60p or up to 120p, you need the two. You just need that extra 6 gigs of data rate to be recorded. So you record. You're also recording on board the proxy. Now you play back. And in the playback, the recorders do vary. Some of them will do processing inside and will debayer inside. Some of them will just play back those four components. And now you come into a computer, and we have software, and some other manufacturers are now developing software where we debayer in software in non-real time. We're getting faster and faster, but it's non-real time. So this is not terrific for television, live television, but for television drama, for movie making, etc., it works perfectly. And then you do your color grading. And then last but not least, the beauty of having this come out, your 4K as a raw signal over 3G SDI standardized, it can plug and play with any equipment that recognizes that 3G SDI. And we were able to transmit that 4K over a long fiber optic link into a truck where it was debayered and then brought into an Evert's Dreamcatcher 4K. And in the truck, they were able to do digital zooming on the Daytona races, extract an HD close-up digitally. And that has become very hot in all of the sports. You've probably heard a lot about it. And last, before I've got 1 second left, this was a system we put together, 4K in Japan last October, where we originated in a ball field, four 4K cameras, transmitting live 60p 4K into the truck. That was then encoded, sent by satellite to a theater in Tokyo. It was shot in Sendai, and they were watching 4K football live from this camera. So that just gives you an overview of the state of the art today. And I will wrap up with my one slide saying, if I look at my program genres again, I'll show you a table where I put down the decision makers and your choice of a camera, the program genres. I write in those that are partial to shallow depth of field, and I would suggest those that are in red here could use the large format, single sensor, shallow depth of field. And on that basis, I would argue that they are not foe but friend to the television program production community. Thank you for your attention.
We can take a couple of questions if we have
one. One right here.
One comment and one question. You said there were no major films shot on the 5D Mark II, but I've seen a bunch of them. Act of Valor was shot entirely with 5D Mark IIs.
Not entirely, but mostly.
Okay.
There was even film used in that, but it was more. I don't know a film that was 100%. That's why I was being careful. Act of Valor was shot largely with 5D Mark IIs. A lot of them, some of which were blown up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you.
And the other question is, are you contemplating and working on single link 4K full throttle? I know you do dual link, but are you thinking of single link?
Yes, we're thinking of it. This was our first step. Our guys are already working based on our experiences in the field. We're already on the drawing board of what we might do in the next generation. And issues like that have been fed to us by quite a few people. So
okay.
I can't guarantee it, but we're certainly looking at it.
Good.
Yes. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.